You are listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information. Located in Lowell, Massachusetts, we read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. Lab Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. Lab would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support.
This is Fran reading the Saturday Sun. We're looking at December 6th. At the very top of the page is a small photo of Acting Director of U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Todd Lyons. And this is an article from the Herald. This is by Tim Dunn with the Herald. His email address is tim.dunn, D-U-N-N, at bostonherald.com. Says Acting ICE Director Todd Lyons is slamming Democratic Congressman Seth Moulton for calling to prosecute an agent, the agency. Moulton had made comments to reporters Monday following an oversight tour of the ICE facility in Burlington and said if Democrats are to regain a majority in Congress, that, quote, the abuses of ICE need to be prosecuted, not just defunded, prosecuted. They need to be held accountable to the law that they claim to enforce, end quote. In a phone interview with the Herald, furious Lyons called Moulton's words disgusting, going on to question why a congressman would take such a stance against law enforcement. In disgusting again, he says that's pure political theater, and I don't understand why the congressman wants to go ahead and call for the prosecution of law enforcement officers that are his actual constituents. There are people that are out there in the country illegally, and ICE is following the law. Specifically, for Congressman Moulton, ICE is following the law that he and his counterparts have codified and written and had the opportunity to change. So instead of calling for the doxing and the violence and the resistance against ICE officers and their agents, or saying that their agents need to be prosecuted, they should be trying to fix the Immigration Nationality Act, which they have the power to do, yet don't have the strength or the stomach to do it, end quote. Moulton is hitting back at Lyons, telling the Herald in a fiery response that, quote, anyone who violates the law should be prosecuted. This is actually very simple, he said. Anyone who violates the law should be prosecuted. And that includes ICE officials. This administration, from Donald Trump to Secretary of War Hegseth to ICE abusing their authority in our streets, seems to think they are above the law. Todd Lyons, of all people whose service predates the Trump administration, should understand this, end quote. This is Moulton speaking. And continuing, he says, you can't watch the numerous videos of unarmed men and women being violently arrested, little kids getting used as bait to get their parents, or priests being assaulted for exercising their First Amendment rights, and not say that many of Trump's immigration enforcers aren't breaking the law. Real leaders take responsibility for their subordinates, rather than whining about the members of Congress who are fulfilling our oversight responsibilities to ensure that they do, end quote. Lyons went on to question if Moulton, who is running for U.S. Senate against incumbent Markey in the September primary, is trying to heighten his political image for his campaign. He's quoted as saying, I'm not sure why he would go ahead and want to run on a platform where you want to have law enforcement officers and agents prosecuted. I think his comments will backfire. I've had so many prominent individuals in Massachusetts and so many local law enforcement leaders reach out to me and say they were just as outraged and couldn't believe it as well. So I'm not sure why he would want to use the facts of the brave men and women of ICE just to gather some votes, end quote. Moulton did not respond to Lyons' claims of political motivation for his comments, but he did go on to further criticize the agency, along with Customs and Border Protection, which is known as CBP, and Homeland Security Investigations, which is known as HSI. Quoting him, there's nobody I've met who hates bad cops more than good cops because they give everyone in law enforcement a bad name. And that's what the abuses of ICE, HSI, and CBP are doing in America today, said Moulton. The Boston Herald also asked Lyons about comments made on the House floor Wednesday by a Democratic Congresswoman, Ayanna Pressley, who claimed that her office has documented, quote, hundreds of cases, end quote, of ICE unlawfully arresting legal residents using excessive force or racial profiling. According to Presley, rogue, masked federal agents are violating people's civil rights, glorified bullies masquerading as public servants, end quote. Markey has also chimed in with his own allegations of abuses by ICE, posting on X on Tuesday about an oversight tour of the ICE facility in Louisiana, where he says pregnant women detained at the facility reported medical neglect and infections resulting in miscarriages. Lyons says Presley and Markey's claims are, quote, absolutely ridiculous, end quote. He went on to say ICE doesn't deport U.S. citizens or other individuals who are here legally. That is just a flat-out lie, and you constantly hear nowadays that ICE is doing this. I will tell you that only U.S. citizens that are being arrested in Massachusetts are the ones who are listening to elected officials like them that decide to resist ICE or illegally interfere with the lawful ICE operations. Moulton's visit to the Burlington facility came following allegations of abuse and inhumane treatment of detainees by local activists. They claim detainees are held in rooms without basic necessities, including beds, windows, soap, clocks, and hardly any food or water. They also say detainees are being held at the facility for long periods of time without due process. Following the visit, Moulton told reporters and demonstrators that the observations he made during his previous visit to the facility in June remained the same, but he did note that detainees seemed to have been getting processed in a more timely manner. Lyons had also responded to the Herald's inquiry on the allegations in a previous report, saying that the facility in Burlington is meant to temporarily hold detainees until they are moved elsewhere. And we have another SNAP benefit related article by the State House News Service, written by Sam Drysdale, Dateline Boston. It says Governor Mari Healy called the Trump administration's latest SNAP funding threat outrageous, saying Massachusetts already collects the data the administration is looking for and doesn't consider it relevant to provide it to the federal government. Speaking with reporters Tuesday, Healy criticized President Trump's warning to withhold SNAP administrative funds from Massachusetts and other Democratic-led states unless those states provide certain information about those who receive the assistance. She said that that punishes working families, seniors, children, and people with disabilities. Quoting her, "What President Trump needs to do immediately is order Secretary Rollins to release SNAP funding and ensure that Americans don't go hungry," end quote. Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins said that the administration may cut SNAP funds because some states have refused to provide data about the recipients, including their names and immigration status, so as to help identify potential fraud. He continued, "We asked for all the states for the first time to turn over their data to the federal government to let the USDA partner with them to root out this fraud, to make sure that those who really need food stamps are the ones getting them," said Rollins, "but also to ensure that the American taxpayer is protected," end quote. Rollins said that states that have complied have reported some irregularities, including roughly 186,000 deceased individuals who received benefits and 500,000 cases of duplicate benefits. However, the agency has not released detailed data on how much in benefits are affected by error or fraud. Quoting Rollins again, "If a state won't share data on criminal use of SNAP benefits, it won't get a dollar of federal SNAP administrative funding. Let's see which states stand for accountability and which are just protecting their bribery schemes," end quote. About 42 million Americans rely on SNAP, with an average monthly benefit of roughly $190 per person. Healy said that Massachusetts already verifies eligibility for SNAP beneficiaries and considers the federal request unnecessary. She commented, "Waste, fraud, and abuse is something that I take very seriously. The data is not relevant. The court has already decided this," end quote. Responding to SNAP data requests from the Trump administration earlier this year, Massachusetts and other Democratic-led states filed a lawsuit, fearing the data might be used for deportations. Attorney General Andrea Campbell is quoted as saying, "I will not allow this administration to fuel their cruel immigration agenda with information wrongfully taken from families who are just trying to make ends meet. I'm proud to stand with my colleagues in demanding federal privacy laws are upheld." She said this back in July when she filed the suit to halt the data collection. President Bill Clinton appointed Judge Maxine Chesney sided with the states to temporarily freeze the Trump administration's plan to compel them to share this sensitive information. She's quoted as saying, "As plaintiff states are required by law to safeguard information they obtain from applicant households, they are, in effect, prohibited from disclosing it where the recipient announces in advance an intent to use it for some other purpose." She wrote this in a restraining order. The states argued that the U.S. Department of Agriculture risked violating federal privacy laws. And they quoted, "It looks like now they're going to have to go back to court." And this is, again, Healy speaking. "But this is all made-up stuff. And it's really unfortunate. And you know who's paying every single day. Our mothers and fathers worried sick about how they're going to feed their kids. That's what's happening now, and it shouldn't happen in America." End of quote. The USDA's administrative funds, which could be withheld, cover the costs states incur to operate SNAP, including processing applications, verifying eligibility, and ensuring compliance. The direct benefits provided to recipients are fully funded by the federal government and are not being withheld, according to the agency. Disrupted administrative funding could slow or complicate benefit delivery. The federal government gave the states until December 8th to respond to the data requests. Campbell also joined another legal challenge against the Trump administration's SNAP policies last week. Back on November 26th, she joined 21 other state attorneys general in filing a lawsuit to block federal guidance that the coalition says unlawfully restricts SNAP eligibility for certain legal immigrants. The guidance, issued by USDA in late October, mischaracterized eligibility for permanent residents, refugees, asylees, and other humanitarian entrants, even after they obtain green cards. This is according to Campbell. The lawsuit argues that the USDA guidance misapplies federal law and agency regulations. Under federal statutes, refugees, asylees, humanitarian parolees, and other legal immigrants become eligible for SNAP once they meet standard program requirements. Again, Campbell is speaking here now. The Trump administration continues to evade its responsibility to feed people, this time by targeting our immigrant communities. And she said that in a recently released press statement. It does mention that Mr. Drysdale is a reporter for the State House News Service and for State Affairs Pro Massachusetts. The name is Sam Drysdale, but it apparently is a woman. It says you can reach her at sdrysdale@statehousenews.com, S-D-R-Y-S-D-A-L-E, at statehousenews.com. And on the front page, the remaining of the page, is a lovely photo. Two photos, one black and white and a large color, making up the rest of the front page. The large color photo shows Stanisława or Stasia Krygowska Woltosz, maiden name Ferus, who on December 3rd, 2025, is seated with a framed recognition from the Polish government for her service in the Polish underground resistance movement during the German occupation in World War II. She's now living in Chelmsford, and she celebrated just now her 100th birthday on December 1st. The smaller black and white photo shows her in another frame along other official recognitions that she has received, and it shows her as a young woman with the stamped passport pass as she was in the World War Resistance Group. This by Peter Currier, who gives his email address as pcurrier@lowellsun.com, pcurrier@lowellsun.com, Dateline Chelmsford. It says, when Stanisława or Stasia Krygowska Woltosz or Ferus, F-E-R-U-S, was a teenager in the southeastern Polish village of Odrzykon, that's O-D-R-Z-Y-K-O-N, she remembers seeing what she first believed to be military exercises at a nearby airfield. What Stasia would soon realize when bombs began falling on the airfield was that they were not normal military exercises. It was September 1939, and Nazi Germany was in the beginning stages of invading Poland from the west, while the Soviet Union simultaneously invaded from the east. Odrzykon, the town, would find itself under the control of the Germans, who pushed from the west through much of Poland's south and southeast all the way into parts of the country that are now part of modern-day Ukraine. This invasion marked what is widely considered to be the start of the European theater of World War II, and the start of what would be the most harrowing period in the lives of Stasia and the Ferris family. She was born on December 1, 1925, in Odrzykon. She now lives in Chelmsford, and this year she celebrated her 100th birthday with more than 24 family and friends. She also sat down with The Sun to talk about her first-hand experience with events most only we read about in history books. One of her brothers, named Karol, K-A-R-O-L, was killed in the fighting in 1939, but her other brother, Stanisław, S-T-A-N-I-S-L-A-W, joined up with the Polish underground, also known as the Home Army or the Armia Krajowa, or simply as AK, which is believed to have been the largest resistance group in Europe during the war, at an estimated 400,000 members. There we see also another black and white photo of her as a young girl with her sisters Helena and Sofia, her brother-in-law Gan, and her younger brother Veso. This is probably taken when she was just still in her teens. It says now 100 and living in Chelmsford, she and her members of her family served in the Polish underground resistance movement during the German occupation in World War II. At the start of this occupation, Stasia was just 14, and she was considered too young to join the AK. Her older brother, Stanisław, was able to join and took on the role of district commander under a code name Orlik, O-R-L-I-K. One of his main roles was to listen to a radio, which was often moved to different sympathetic houses to avoid detection by German occupiers. That radio would receive broadcasts from the Polish exiled government in London to help direct AK forces and provide updates on the movement of the front lines. Stasia is quoted here as saying, they were sending from the west very important information, such as the airplane will come on this day, at this time, in these woods, so build a fire so the pilot will know where to drop printer paper and a little printer. She was translated, as she spoke, by her daughter, Maria Bielawska, B-I-E-L-A-W-S-K-A, and their friend Francis Nowak. They said also, they also sent information about the German army and the Russian army also. Printer and paper would be used to print memos that Stanisław would put together from the radio broadcast and distribute them to different AK cells to keep them informed and provide orders. The distribution of these bulletins, which were titled Reduta, R-E-D-U-T-A, would be where Stasia found her role when she was finally old enough to join AK when she turned 16, and she earned the code name Mała Stasia, meaning Little Stasia. By this point in 1941, Germany had launched Operation Barbarossa, betraying the Soviet Union and their alliance under the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, and Nazi troops were pushing deep into Soviet territory while at the same time continuing to occupy Poland. Stasia used to hide these bulletins under her clothing to smuggle them to AK cells or various dead drops. As the front line moved, her trips would even take her right along the contact line between German and Soviet troops once the Soviets had begun pushing the Germans back. She recalls crossing the Wisłok River, that's W-I-S-L-O-K, multiple times while bullets from both armies were snapping overhead as the two sides clashed. She said there were many times during the week, back and forth, back and forth. They needed to know during the war where the Americans were landing, how the German army is moving to the east. And while many supported the resistance to the Nazi occupation in Poland, still, Stasia said, it could be difficult to find someone to trust. There were some people, she said, who were trustworthy, or who we thought could be trustworthy, and they turned out not to be. For money, they could betray you, end quote. Stasia and her family would go through a terrifying experience with the Gestapo, the infamous secret police of Nazi Germany, after a neighbor of theirs gave away the family's involvement with the AK and the bulletins that they were distributing. Stasia is quoted as saying, they came knocking on the door one night in the middle of the night. Her father, not knowing who it was, answered the door. But Stasia said she quickly realized what was happening and escaped out a back window to warn her brother Stanislav, who was just living three houses away at the time. By the time she returned, the Gestapo had already figured out that one person was missing from the house, and she was unsuccessful in explaining away her absence as a trip to the outhouse. She had actually hopped out of the windows barefoot in the snow. Waiting in a car with the Gestapo outside was the person who had turned the family in. Stasia, her father Yusef, and Stanislav's wife, Renia, were taken to a prison in Krosno, K-R-O-S-N-O, and then to the city of Jaslo, J-A-S-L-O. There, Stasia remembers she and the others were beaten, and as she described the ordeal, she mimed that repeated blows that she took to her face. While Stasia and her sister-in-law were on the first level going through this of the building, they could hear the sound of the Gestapo beating her father and telling him that she had already told them everything. But despite the beatings and attempts to make the other families out to have betrayed each other, Stasia said that none of them talked, no one gave away Stanislav, and eventually she and her father were released, left at the side of a road to walk about 30 kilometers back to their home in the dark in March, periodically jumping under cover when cars passed in case they were occupied by more Gestapo. The sister-in-law, Rainier, was released separately afterwards and was able to finally find a train to take back home. It arrived before Stasia or Yusef. Amid a story of a neighbor's betrayal was also an example of unexpected kindness. The family, which was left wondering why they were ultimately released, they would later learn they received the vouching of a Dr. Heinrich Klein, a German military doctor who had been quartered in Stasia's home. It was quite common during the German occupations for soldiers and officers to be quartered in the homes of citizens. Stasia said that Klein likely didn't know for sure about her family's involvement with AK, but probably suspected something was up. She said, quoting her, he knew something wasn't quite right in the house, end quote. But what exactly he knew, he vouched for the family's innocence, and why he did so is still a mystery. But Stasia said she told her father it was he who got them released. He was a German, but he was a good man, she said of Klang. They never knew for sure what ultimately became of Mr. Klang, as he was eventually transferred with his unit to the Eastern Front in the fight against the Soviets, where Stasia and her family think it was likely he was killed. The Soviets would eventually push the Germans back through Poland, and while the village of Ojukonk was liberated from the Nazis, the Soviets brought their own authoritarianism and distrust between neighbors. Even though AK was actively fighting against the Nazi occupation, Soviets treated the resistance as enemies due to the help that the resistance group received from the Western Allies, and Stanislav was made to remain in hiding until 1956, in the era of so-called de-Stalinization. Stasia said this was seen like an enemy for the Russians because they were connected with London. The Russians knew all about my brother, but they were unable to catch him. Maria, her daughter, was born in 1948 and lived most of her life in Poland before moving to the United States in 1988. But her father died before she was born. In 1958, Stasia took a job in a local factory producing glass for scientific instruments, a job that she would keep for decades. But when Maria was 16 years of age, Stacia remarried. Maria remembers growing up in a house under constant surveillance by the Soviet government. They knew about her family's history with the AK. She said there were a lot of people working for the Russians, working for the communists. My house was always under observation. They would come in the night, walking through the garden, jumping over the fence. They came up to the house and looked in the window for any suspicious newspapers or bulletins. But we were not in the organization anymore, said Maria. Stacia's brother had left, but they wanted to know where her brother lived. It would take decades for Stacia and other AK members to get official recognition for their action during the war, which was mainly possible only when the Soviet Union fell. Now, 80 years after the end of the war, Stacia is believed to be the only remaining certified AK member from her village. In 2007, Maria brought her mother, Stacia, to live in the United States. At 100 years, Stacia tries to stay informed about current events both in the United States and Poland, thanks both to a translation service for American news and a streaming service that offers Polish news broadcasts. She was an avid vegetable gardener, though she had to step back for it this year to her displeasure. She attributes good genes, a family history of living long, and good natural diet to her own longevity. And on the local news page, at the top of the page, we have an Aaron Curtis article from New Hampshire, this time Dateline Hudson, New Hampshire. His email address, acurtis@lowellsun.com, acurtis@lowellsun.com. It says police have arrested a Nashua, New Hampshire man in connection with a fatal fentanyl overdose, alleging he sold the fentanyl that caused a Hudson woman's death. The Hudson Police Department said that Jason Canfield, 33 years of age, faces felony charges, including the sale of a controlled drug resulting in death, for allegedly providing the potent opioid to a 54-year-old woman who the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner determined died of fentanyl toxicity. Police arrested Canfield after tracing the alleged fentanyl sale through text messages, surveillance footage, and cell phone data. In a supporting affidavit for Canfield's arrest, submitted by the Hudson police, the woman's husband told investigators that the two had been relaxing at home on the night of August 25th before going to bed when the tragedy unfolded. He recalled that she fell asleep in the living room and he placed a blanket over her. He later told police that he noticed her breathing was what he thought was lethargic, but he assumed she was in a deep sleep. About an hour later, he checked on her and found her unresponsive. Because of her history of mental health and drug addiction, he administered two doses of Narcan and began chest compressions until Hudson firefighters arrived. According to the affidavit, emergency crews arrived on the scene just after midnight on August 26th and continued resuscitation efforts before pronouncing her deceased. Investigators later examined the woman's phone and found deleted text messages with a contact saved as Jay. J-A-Y, allegedly discussing the purchase of fentanyl in the days leading up to her death. In the messages, the drugs were referred to as sticks, a term police say is commonly used to mean 10 grams of fentanyl. The messages included arrangements to meet on August 25th with Jay, texting at around 10:10 p.m. the word here, H-E-R-E. Detectives identified Jay as Canfield, linking him through phone records, WhatsApp data, surveillance footage, all according to the affidavit, cell tower information and mapping with assistance from the Drug Enforcement Administration, allegedly showed Canfield traveled from Nashua to Lawrence, Mass., a city police described as a source city for illicit narcotics, before traveling to Hudson the night of the overdose. Police alleged that they were able to determine that Canfield's cell phone was connecting to a cell tower in the area of that 54-year-old woman's home at approximately 10:07 p.m. on August 25th. It was approximately 1 minute after he had allegedly texted her stating, quote, three men, meaning minutes, end quote. The Hudson Police said in a press release issued on Thursday that detectives located Canfield at a Nashville residence on November 25th, and with assistance from the Nashville Police Department's problem-oriented policing unit, he was taken into custody without incident. He was arraigned the following day in the Ninth Circuit Nashville District Court and remained in custody pending a probable cause hearing on Thursday, at which point a judge ordered him held in the Hillsborough County Jail. In addition to sale of a controlled drug resulting in death, a Class A felony, Canfield is charged with sale of a controlled drug, a Class B felony. Police say the case remains active and ongoing. Canfield, identified in court documents as indigent, is represented by a New Hampshire Public Defender's Office. The office was not available immediately for comment. And we have a black and white photo here also on the page showing Billerica police officers Thomas Huff, H-U-F-F, and Robert Lee standing with several Amazon packages loaded into cruises. This also by Aaron Curtis in Dateline Billerica. It says Santa may have his sleigh, but in Billerica, police cruises work just as well. That was made clear at about 8:10 p.m. November 25th, when Officer Samuel Hawks, H-A-W-K-E-S, spotted 8 Amazon packages scattered across the road while he was paroling behind Town Plaza at 700 Boston Road. Teaming up with Officer Matthew Irwin, they checked to make sure the packages were intended for Billerica addresses, and then they hand-delivered each box to its rightful home, ensuring that nothing was missing. But a week later, the situation repeated itself. At about 1:15 a.m. December 2nd, Officer Thomas Huff discovered 8 Amazon packages scattered in the roadway in the 200 block of Salem Road. Like Hawks and Irwin before him, Huff took on the role of Santa's helper, delivering every package safely to Billerica residents. In both instances, the officers notified Amazon about their discovery. These two incidents really highlight the care that Billerica police officers put into their jobs, said their chief, Roy Frost, and whether they're responding to a major emergency or just ensuring that residents get lost packages during the holiday season, I'm proud of these officers. I should say so. The opinion page and the article, as the editorial, is called Be an Informed Donor if you're weighing a charitable gift. It says, with the holiday season of giving in full swing, prospective donors to charities should do their due diligence when selecting the recipients of their generosity. That's the advice that State Attorney General Andrea Campbell wants to impart for those who are contemplating a donation. It will help you steer clear of top-heavy charities that keep the majority of your gifts for administrative purposes, and also from unscrupulous groups that are just seeking to capitalize on your good intentions. Campbell said, quoting her, "As we enter this holiday season, I want to remind residents that your generosity is more important than ever, but so is your vigilance," end quote. While some charities raise their own funds, others pay professional solicitors to seek donations. Charities and solicitors, by statute, must register with the Attorney General's office. If contacted by a professional fundraiser, consumers should determine how much of every dollar they donate will actually go to the charity. In general, follow these steps before donating. Know your charity. Before you donate, verify the charity's name, address, number, email address, and website if available. Next, find out where your money goes. Ask how much of your money the charity will receive. Beware of statements such as, quote, "all proceeds go to charity," end quote, because terms like proceeds could refer to net amounts after the fundraiser's fee is deducted. Next, keep records. Retain all receipts and canceled checks along with emails and texts in case you have a complaint later. If you are eligible to deduct charitable contributions from your gross income, they'll also come in handy when filing your annual income tax returns. Next, don't feel pressured. Take time to decide if you want to donate. A legitimate charity will tell you how it's using your money to make the difference. Next, don't pay by cash or debit card. Pay by credit card or check, especially if donating online. A record of the transaction will be created if you pay by credit card, and you may be able to stop payment if you later change your mind. Under Massachusetts law, public charities operating within the state must register and file annual reports with the AGO's Nonprofit Organizations Public Charities Division. These filings, available to the public online, provide valuable information about a charitable organization's programs, activities, and financing. Consumers also may check with the IRS to determine if donations to certain organizations are tax deductible. Individuals with inquiries or complaints about charitable solicitations should call the Attorney General's Nonprofit Organizations Public Charities Division. That number is 617-963-2101, 617-963-2101, or you can file a complaint online. The best way to avoid any charity pitfalls, donate to the two local trusted organizations that annually help thousands of area individuals in need, especially in this season. One, the Sun Santa Fund, and two, the Lowell and Fitchburg branches of the Salvation Army. And there's another editorial entitled Detecting Older Drivers' Decline Could Save Lives. AAA Northeast once again has decided to use the publicity generated by National Older Driver Safety Awareness Week to highlight the disturbing increase of deadly traffic crashes involving elderly drivers. According to AAA, from 2014 to 2023, the population of those 65 and older in the United States grew by 28%. During the same period, the number of old drivers involved in deadly crashes rose by 41%. Mark Sheldorp, who's a senior spokesman for AAA Northeast, said, "It's critical to balance the need for seniors to be active in their communities with safety behind the wheel. Families and caregivers can help seniors stay safe on the road by encouraging them to keep their driving skills sharp and having an open and honest conversation if changes are needed," end quote. In Massachusetts, more than 420 deadly crashes from 2020 to 2024 involved older drivers, accounting for 22% of all crashes, which resulted in fatalities during that period. Mr. Sheldrup advises older drivers to avoid night driving and schedule appointments outside of rush hour to reduce risks. Driving professionals also emphasize the importance of discussing vision and cognitive changes with older drivers, which could impact their safety on the road. This rise in deadly crashes correlates with the growing number of licensed drivers 65 or older nationwide, which reached approximately 52.9 million in 2023, an increase of 60 million from a decade ago. AAA research indicates that while seniors are less likely to engage in risky behavior compared to younger drivers, they face a higher risk of being killed or seriously injured in crashes. AAA offers the following tips for senior drivers and their families to enhance safety. First, review new technologies. Today's vehicles often come equipped with a variety of safety features, from lane keeping assistance to adaptive cruise control. Review your car's manual or watch video tutorials to ensure that you're comfortable with how those systems work. Next, monitor your health. Various medical conditions, eyesight problems, or memory issues as you age can make driving more challenging, and some medications can impair your driving ability. Talk with your doctor and pharmacist about your unique medical history. Next, adjust your driving habits when it's necessary. Families should discuss the best strategies to keep an older driver safe behind the wheel. Next and last, wear your seatbelt. It's the best protection you can give yourself in the event of a crash. With the increasing number of older drivers on the road, AAA Northeast emphasizes the importance of safety measures and open communication to reduce the risk of deadly crashes.
Thanks for listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. There are many ways to listen to Lab Radio. Request a free specialized receiver, or for more information about our radio reading service, call Lab at 978-454-5704. You can listen to Lab Radio anytime by dialing 1-631-359-9069. Or visit our website where you can tune into Lab Radio at LowellAssociationForTheBlind.org. Thanks for listening.